Hey there, everyone. Time to kick off another exciting session. Welcome to our DevOps Office Hours. It's March 29th, 2023. I'm Eric Osterman, founder and CEO of Cloud Posse, and I'll be your host today. Cloud Posse is the DevOps accelerator you need. We power companies with our rock solid Terraform blueprints, and we're so confident in the results, we even offer a money back guarantee. Whether you're starting from scratch or just not satisfied with your current setup, head to cloudposse.com/quiz. Again, cloudposse.com/quiz to book a session with me. I'll show you exactly what your AWS future can look like starting right now. If you're new here, don't worry. Our format is super informal. My goal is to answer your questions. If you're curious about Cloud Posse or any of our awesome open source software tools, this is a great place to ask. For those joining us through our podcast or YouTube channel, we host these calls every week, so don't miss out. Register for these live sessions by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, cloudposse.com/officehours. Our call today is recorded. We'll be posting a recording of this session to our YouTube channel. So if you want to support what we do over here, please hit those like and subscribe buttons. It helps us out a great deal. Just go to youtube.com/cloudposse. And that said, don't forget to share these with your team. It's a great way to keep everyone on the same page. So lots of exciting announcements that came up over this past week. Well, more or less exciting. I'm sure many of you like us were bit by the rotation of GitHub's SSH key. It was human error and it happens to the best of them. So one of their engineers apparently committed the private key to an internal repository. And obviously as a protective measure, they immediately rotated it once discovering that that had happened, since private keys are incredibly sensitive. That then maybe kicked off other implications for others. One of the things that happened was, like if you're running Argo CD, that probably stopped doing continuous delivery to your clusters because it didn't trust the host key anymore from GitHub. Now, if that wasn't enough, I think it was the same week, for a brief time, also the SSL certificate expired for GitHub user content, failing probably tens of millions of builds around the world in a few minutes. That was my number. Any other news related to that whole certificate? SSH certificate being rotated.
I'll just add that their bad luck continues because they had a major pages and actions outage for several hours today that still lingering.
Yeah,
I feel like that's on a weekly basis. Yeah, like actions goes down.
Like we got exactly like what Mike said. It's like I didn't even think to bring it up because I mean we all know GitHub has been down pretty much every day in some capacity for the last few weeks. I don't know, they must be doing some big changes over there because it's been really unstable lately.
We joke that as soon as Microsoft bought them, that's when they started becoming unstable. But
I totally take that. Except for, I mean, I think it's overall been really improving in some ways.
Right. The improvements are, you know, amazing. Yeah, I will say that.
It's probably highly related to Microsoft bought them. The rate of change increased significantly with the number of features and everything they were delivering, and stability has taken a hit as a result.
Yeah, I would agree with that assessment. Somebody else was chiming in there in between. Sorry, we cut you off. All right. Another link someone shared with me, I thought it was kind of cool. If you are a console warrior using GitHub, it's a nice little CLI tool, lets you navigate the most common things you might be interacting with on the command line, in some ways similar to kind of what you get through the web. So viewing issues and PRs, navigating through that and leaving comments, even viewing them inline. So pretty cool. I like that. Something that what's going on? I linked to the wrong thing. Terraform provider. This is not necessarily an endorsement of this provider. It's a small little esoteric provider that came across our screen because somebody opened a pull request using it. And this is not a criticism. I thought it was incredibly clever, but just because it's clever doesn't mean we should use it. If you have this problem where you're running your Terraform and it crashes because like count of cannot be computed or some problem because the values in your for each loop are unknown, it will error. This is a way to provide mock values during that time, provided you know it will work at apply time because other things are getting created. So it's kind of you outsmarting Terraform. Now, because you're outsmarting Terraform, you're kind of getting ready to blow your leg off, or however the expression goes, because you're circumventing.
You're playing with fire.
You're playing with fire. You're circumventing protections that are there for your protection, not theirs. Nonetheless, clever solution. Here was the way it was used, if I can find it here quickly. Oops, that was the wrong link. So you use this resource called value is fully known to provide an output data structure that's similar to what you would have expected, and you can pass that in. All right, we'll share those links later. This was one that I came across. I can't remember if I came across it before, but seeing it again, got really excited about it. I just don't understand why this is not a core feature yet of GitHub to manage repo settings through a configuration file. That configuration file can be managed with code owners, so it's protected and you can't hijack the repos. But this is a brilliant example of just being able to manage everything quite simply through this file. Now, I'm personally conflicted, and I'll open this up for feedback from others on the approach to this. There's three major approaches I see to managing GitHub repositories. One is a method like this, either with a GitHub action or this GitHub app that actually does it. The other is some homebrewed solution, either using some of the existing tools out there, there's many of them to do it, to manage it centrally, for example, in a repository settings repository inside of your organization. And the last one is some maybe variation of that or these other ones, like doing it with Terraform. Obviously, we do a lot of Terraform. There are a lot of Terraform solutions to manage it out there. My concern using Terraform or anything of the like is hitting those rate limits. And when you manage 500 repositories, that's a real concern. And the centralized approach, I also don't like because it's kind of like one repo to knock them all over, right? Like that one repo then has to have admin to everything to be able to change permissions on everything. And that can happen rapidly. Like one change can possibly affect 100% of your repositories unless you have circuit breakers in there. So I'm still leaning towards this idea where a single repository manages those GitHub settings akin to what we have in front of us, but open to dissenting opinions or other implementations. Any thoughts? All right. Next announcement is, this is a bigger one. I haven't had time to fully digest it, but I am not looking forward to it. When the V4 provider first came out, it sent some shockwaves through open source maintainers of Terraform modules, breaking core functionality, deprecating it immediately with how things like S3 buckets worked. I think there were other breaking changes as well. That was reverted in a subsequent patch release and then pushed off to this major release 5. Now we've had a year to deal with it, so it's on us, but it still sucks. If you are depending on any resources that provision buckets or the like, I think it also maybe affects security groups and how they're managed. There's some breaking changes that you have to account for. And we're going to have to account for that. Any other things people want to point out? All right.
How often do you feel a new version comes out? Like, I feel like V4 was just very recently, but like you said, it was probably a year ago at this point. And then when did V3 come out before that? I guess how often does this move?
It feels yearly at this point.
Yeah.
I'm guessing these changes are going to be fewer and fewer, though, less radical, because Terraform as a project is becoming more mature and they're making better decisions up front. Mm-hmm. I think some of these things are just to improve how that you work with the underlying resources based on battle scars. So, I mean, the changes are welcome, right? But just,
yeah.
Unfortunate. My answer is yearly based on anecdotal.
Yeah.
Also, it's interesting. I wonder how many have switched over to using the Cloud Control API, the other AWS CC provider. That's the other thing that's nagging, right? Like, if they're not interchangeable and resources, yeah, I mean, you can't just migrate easily the state between doing it one way or the other. And
What we had to use that for the Slack AWS support case integration. Like, there's no. For the AWS provider, there's no seemingly support, but for the AWS CC, you could do it all. And, what exactly is this? So, like, I didn't get to wrap my head around it just because we just wanted to implement it pretty quickly. But
it's not very production ready, is the nice way to put it. So, the AWS CC provider is missing a lot of features. It's not that actively developed, so I wouldn't migrate to it yet, and I don't see folks migrating to it in the next, at least the next year. So that's the current state. Like, it's fine, just use the normal AWS Terraform provider. Ignore AWS CC. It's not even close to being ready. Now, what AWS CC is, it's an auto-generated provider. So AWS has APIs for all the things. If you want support for a new resource in the AWS provider for Terraform, somebody has to go in, code that up, open up a pull request, get that reviewed, merge. It's a whole thing. It requires a lot of manual effort. AWS, after many folks complained, realized that and admitted that, yeah, we have very inconsistent and chaotic APIs. Sorry. Here's a thing we built, Cloud Control API, that gives you uniform APIs for all the services. Like, it's basically a CRUDL API. Create, read, update, delete, and list. It works across all services. Every single service that launches has support for this. It's built in. So the idea was, okay, awesome. Now we don't have to do manual stuff for every single new update in the Terraform AWS provider. We can just automatically generate the code and using these known APIs and just do that in the CC provider. The idea is awesome. The initiative is awesome. The focus is not there. Like, HashiCorp doesn't seem to be allocating a lot of effort in here. AWS is also not allocating a lot of effort is maybe the wrong wording here. It's not allocating enough effort to justify moving. Does this make sense?
Yeah, that does. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for providing that context. Actually, I was really curious about, like, who is using it. And it's interesting that you say that it isn't really yet having much adoption, which is reinforced by these stats. Obviously, the AWS provider's been around for a very long time, but the scale of downloads is just phenomenal. So 362,000 downloads this year versus this year, 200 million downloads of the AWS provider. So no comparison there. But so Vlad, are you telling me, my understanding was what you said, that it can be all auto-generated. I was just curious, seeing this PR coming in from a person then and not some other system, Was this auto-generated therefore, or?
I.
Oh, here it says generated by. Oh, that was the documentation.
I assume it's auto-generated. I could be wrong. Even if it's not auto-generated, it's a lot less effort.
Yeah. Code generated by generate. Yeah. So there's some piece of it at least that is being generated. Cool.
It's actually saying that whole file is generated by the generator, and it says do not edit if you read the actual comment.
Oh, like this, even like the changelog?
Or like at least if you look at like the main.tf or whatever on there that you just showed, or not the main.tf, the data source code that you just showed, which is in like Go, it actually says like right at the top, see right line 4.
Yeah.
No, I saw that.
Yeah.
I wasn't seeing it though on every file. So that's why I was curious. Like maybe a hybrid.
Yeah. Oh, and then it actually said something about one of the other comments said something about the docs were generated by something else.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw that as you scrolled by.
Yeah, no, I saw that too in the docs somewhere here like this.
Yeah.
All right. Next announcement. That was that. This was via Anton's newsletter, CloudFormation CTL. The idea here is that this gives you a Terraform-esque experience deploying CloudFormation templates, so a plan and apply phase that you can run. I got a little chuckle when I saw the intro. So you're forced to use it based on your organizational principles. All right, then next announcement was something here. So this was a bold move called ErgoMake. Imagine if you could just use Docker Compose files for everything. Here is a company, they have re-implemented Docker Compose, presumably made it pluggable in some way. I haven't read the details of it, but it's no longer just like Docker Compose. Yes, it can launch containers and do things Docker Compose does, but it can also provision infrastructure and do other things. So I thought that was an interesting extreme take. I guess their position is that the Compose schema is very well understood by developers. It's the test of time and still being used and is pretty expressive for what your infrastructure might look like. So I was reading the chat conversation here. So that's what that is. I can't criticize it too much other than I think it could add some confusion by having the identical schema and trying to do things one way. I think I could totally see this being successful in early versions of it, but inevitably you're going to want to extend this to add proprietary features to what ErgoMake can do. And now you're going to break that contract that this is going to be exactly like a Docker Compose file. Or if you don't break it, you're going to start doing, I forget what you call it, but when you write code in comments, which I think is even worse, to have those escape hatches. The other reason I can't really criticize it is it's kind of what we're doing with Atmos in our YAML schema. It's not borrowing on Docker Compose, but it's taking a YAML-based DSL for expressing infrastructure and what we perceive as a simple way to express it that's scalable. They're just using Docker Compose instead. Any other opinions on this one? All right. Next announcement was a public service announcement. So, you know, we talked about Docker's decision to sunset the free teams and the implications of that. One of the things that Matt on our team raised and others was like the potential for now supply chain attacks. If somebody then registers that same team, what happens? Can they now publish nefarious images under the same organization and repository name? Anyways, nothing we need to worry about anymore. They have reversed course and are no longer sunsetting those teams. That said, I'm sure they saw a huge exodus of open source projects. So maybe they got anyway some benefit out of it, reducing their costs. Last announcement is, I'm dubbing it, one-click guard duty. No, they're making it easier to deploy guard duty in organizations so you don't have to manually provision every single member account explicitly and connect them up to your central guard duty. Now you can apparently manage that at the root of the organization.
Yeah, I briefly looked at this and I'm pretty sure the only way you can do it though is through the console. You can't do it through the API yet, which kind of sucks.
Didn't they say the everything new was going to be?
Maybe you can do it in the CC provider.
True.
Yeah. I just looked at the API though. I didn't actually see a way to do it in the API itself. So unless I missed something.
Yeah. All right. That was the end of my announcements. Matt or Vlad, Jeremy, any of you see anything new this week that was interesting?
Debatably, the ALB getting support for TLS 1.3. Some people who were waiting for this to be a thing. It's finally a thing.
I do have a little bit more to mention about the ChatGPT thing. When earlier today, internally, when we were talking, I had seen somebody hand URLs to ChatGPT and it would read web pages. And I guess that's something of a plugin that the GPT-4 supports. I'm still digging around on it. I don't know how official or unofficial it is. I'm more skeptical when I see that it isn't directly OpenAI working on that feature, but that is kind of a thing. I didn't know if anybody had tried out that plugin.
Do you have a link for it?
Let me see. I had been trying to find a good... I wanted to find a GitHub repo on it, actually.
But before you go about, I just wanted to understand this announcement a little bit more. I'm not following. Like, TLS 1.3 on the ALB works by offloading encryption and decryption of TLS traffic from your applications to the local. I mean, isn't that how it's always worked since the beginning of time?
Not if you're using TLS 3. It had to pass through because the ALB didn't support TLS 3 until just recently.
But like when you're using ACM certificates, it's always terminating that at the load balancer and it's all the compute is happening there for the encryption and decryption. And then it's going clear text from the ALB to the application server. So
no, you can use SSL on the back end too, as long as the certificates are trusted by the ALB.
Right, but what I don't understand is then, so how is this offloading this? Yeah, there's something fundamental I don't understand, technically speaking. So if you have the TLS certificates on the application server, then it's obviously the traffic gets re-encrypted and goes to the origin, the application server. But the application servers hosting those certificates and necessarily would have to do the encryption and decryption, no?
If you're doing full end-to-end encryption. But I think what they're saying here is that if you were previously using TLS 3, the only way to make it work was basically by having the certificate and all the encryption and decryption being done on your application server, because the ALB didn't support TLS3. You had to actually just pass through the raw SSL to the application server.
Okay.
Now you can actually offload the SSL onto the ALB because ALB now supports TLS 1.3.
Okay. I think I understand. Yeah. So your point is that since the ALB previously didn't support 1.3, if you wanted to support 1.3, you had to use something like an NLB perhaps.
Yeah, exactly.
Pass it directly through and then your application. Now you can have 1.3 at the edge of your, you know, on your load balancer. So it handles the bulk of the encryption, decryption.
And right. And 1.3, the big thing is that like the handshakes are much faster. The way that it supports like some of the encryption, it's basically just a significantly like several milliseconds for each step of the like the handshake faster in 1.3 over 1.2.
Okay.
Like on the order of magnitude, the full handshake is like 100 milliseconds faster or something like that.
That's significant. That's very significant. And Alex is posting in the chat, hasn't that been there for a while? For TLS listeners, we recommend using ELB security policy. This is the default policy for listeners created using the AWS Management Console. This security policy includes TLS 1.3, which is optimized for security and performance. Is there a date associated with this?
Well, Alex? the policy is June of 2021, according to what he said. Yeah. But I didn't think it actually supported 1.3 until just now, but maybe they were preparing for that or something. Mm. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
All right.
I thought it said NLB at first. I misread what something said.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Jeremy found the link he saw. GPT Advanced Web Chat GPT, a browser extension. Interesting. Yeah. So you, that I could understand would work. So an extension that maybe fetches data and feeds it into ChatGPT for consumption. But ChatGPT itself, so far is not really connected unless you have access to the plugins feature. So I'm guessing this works without any access to the new plugins capability.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see if this counts against the same limits as well. I know with GPT-4, I noticed that I have like a 25 message limit.
Yeah.
So I wonder if using something like this, you end up with sort of reducing that number that you get per hour.
No. I mean, this has nothing to do with it. This is just like running in your browser, fetching data, and instead of you going there, copying and pasting the data from that website, the extension does it for you and then feeds it to ChatGPT. I don't think this reduces in any way your tokens or anything. And okay, this is me clearly having studying the code. No, just a no. Inferring how something like this must work. Yeah. All right. I'm out of announcements. Any other announcements before we go to Q&A? All right, Q&A. So Alex, you posted earlier, this week, some localization challenges you're going through. Let's see here, it's just loading on my screen. Where did it go?
So can I just, I don't think I was crazy when I reread what happened. So the link to the documentation that Alex posted before is in fact for NLBs. When you're creating a TLS listener for NLBs, those policies did support 1.3, which makes sense because you're just cutting through the SSL session directly to your app server, and then it's up to your app server to actually terminate the SSL connection and, you know, do the decryption or encryption and decryption. But this new announcement is specifically for ALBs. Now, ALBs do support natively 1.3. So I was about to say that before, then I second guessed myself, but I went and read the doc just to make sure. And that's what it says. So.
Okay.
No, that's much better.
Yeah.
All right. So, Alex, you're asking here, data regionality and sovereignty is a developing area of regulation and fairly adjacent to GDPR for compliance frameworks like SOC 2 and ISO 27001. I think CCPA has a line item on it. So what should startups do that want to be able to have a global user registration database do? Generally for compliance, it's simply operating in shadow mode until they achieve good compliance reports. But data sovereignty as a new point of concern is a bigger challenge. Anyone have experience with this discussion? I saw somewhere a recommendation to simply leave a copy of the data in each region where it's generated and to export your data to some store and processing location. First thing that comes to mind for me is just because I had a former boss that started this company, Peter Yared, in country. So obviously this is a pay-to-play option. Make it OPP, other people's problems, other platform problems.
Exactly.
But yeah
that's one of the first things that I came up to, but even just convincing certain folks in the usual discussion of what do we need to get to, you know, MVP state, like when can we launch, you know, when do these concerns come up? Should that be something that you have before you have, you know, user one in Germany or Sweden or Vietnam or wherever, you know, yeah. Or do you wait until you have 10,000 users in different countries? But, you know, every country is different on what their requirements are. It's awful.
Yeah. Although almost every one of the countries now essentially has letter of the law actually says, if you offer products or services to residents of that country and you store PII for any of those users that sign up, you must comply with the data residency requirements for that country. So that certainly is how GDPR is. And most of the other regulations I've read are that way. And the long story short is you probably get away with it. Like, this is not legal advice by any means, but until you show up on someone's, you know, radar, you know, you are not probably going to get fined by it, but solving it, you know, solving it for a small startup is definitely not easy and is really costly, because you end up having to host your application in every geography that has a varying law around data residency. And then your user directories and things like that definitely have to be like duplicated or whatever you want to call it, or some distributed, I guess is a better word, is distributed across there. And the way that I've seen most small startups do it on AWS is you end up, they use something like Cognito for authentication. And then you can actually stand up Cognito in every, you know, in every region that makes sense for that. And then you basically can trust the multiple Cognito instances in your central application to get a JWT, you know, from any one of those Cognito services, and then you can run that. But then you actually have to store the PII for those users, like in country. But if you have non-PII, you can then have a central application, instance in the United States, for example. So.
Oh yeah, not usual. My injection there is like, if you have a user that can put their name into a form and click submit, that's PII.
This is very much a legal question, and you should talk with your lawyers about it. Like, it's not, ooh, I'm going to ask the internet what they think about it.
Well, yeah, that's why I said.
you might also be doing a lot of premature optimization here. Get very clear what the laws are now, what you need to do now, and don't stress about, oh, politician in country X said that they're going to require all the data to be stored only on a server that they host in the basement of the government building or something. Talk with your legal team. If you don't have one, sorry, but startup does need a legal team, but talk with them and get the actual requirements and actual needs from them. We're not going to be able to actually provide that much help here.
No, what I'm looking for is just
random articles on the internet.
Low barrier to entry solutions so you can get countries or startups to at least be able to say, you know, and here is a, you know, a two-click deployment solution for data in Canada, data in the US, data in the EU, you know, data somewhere after. Like get those, get a few big check marks done, you know, and then if you're doing something like get like online gambling, then you can start to look at hosting a physical data center presence in all of the small countries that you may want to play. In the US, gambling in the US is ridiculous. You basically have to keep data within each state separately. The whole prospect is awful. But yeah, no, so I was just looking to see what's the lowest barrier to entry solution for this. If it was one of these SaaS solutions like in-country, or I think another one was tokenize, but yeah, just looking for opinions.
Yeah, this
just to be able to say we did due diligence.
I don't know if the VGS does something similar. I mentioned tokenization, so yeah, and it has meet data privacy compliance. So that's another option.
Nice.
All right.
I think the one thing I just want to add really quickly is that I think you're going to find, as you explore all of these things from a technical perspective, that's why I said none of this is legal advice from a technical perspective, you're not going to find an easy solution that's just like click, click, now I'm GDPR compliant, click, click, I'm Canada data compliant, click, click, I'm whatever compliant. There's going to be significant work to make this work within your application architecture if you have to go down this route.
Yeah.
One day it'll be just click, click.
Sounds like a new startup opportunity. That's what I'm going to name my startup, click, click.
Yeah, click, click.
I love it. I'd buy that.
Click, click, GDPR.com. All right. Next one was asked by Kanal Singh, and it was about... can we have something related to Terraform restrictions when running it based on users? If I'm reading between the lines, it's kind of like, how do we get IAM-like capability when we are running Terraform in a CI/CD context? But I'm not 100% sure that that's the ask. Alex suggests using something like M0. That's correct. Any of the taco providers... M0, Terraform Cloud, Spacelift, Scalar, and others have permissions models that can let you say who can run which of those Terraform projects.
If I also can give one if you've rolled your own, like if you're running in CircleCI or you're running in, you know, GitHub Actions or whatever, and you have access to the user context. You can actually use a native Atmos solution with OPA, you know, Open Policy Agent, and you could actually write policy on your particular stacks. Like if you wanted only certain people to be able to run in your dev stack versus your prod stack, you could also kind of grow your own there. It could get a little hairy, but I bet there would be a way to accomplish that without needing to purchase an off-the-shelf product as well.
Yep, that's correct. Thanks for bringing that up. Oops, that's the wrong component validation, is it? Yeah.
Well, and I think, what about the option of just controlling access to the S3 bucket that has the Terraform state? Or is that a different question that I'm reading? if you can't modify or access the Terraform state, you're not going to be able to, so, you know, you can control who has access to that read, write, and so forth.
That is, it shifts it to the bucket, but you're still going to have to, your GitHub action is still going to, then you're going to have lots of IAM roles, for example, and be able to map GitHub OIDC to IAM roles that are narrowly scoped to specific buckets and bucket paths. It's feasible. It would probably be a very ugly user experience, but what would be nice about it, on the other hand, is, well, it's enforced at the IAM level on AWS, but.
Sort of.
Yeah.
I mean, the simplest way is don't give them IAM permissions to to deploy stuff where you don't want them to deploy it. I mean, that you can run Terraform all you want, but you're going to get access denied if you can't actually like run Terraform there. But I think it's more complicated than that, because I think we're talking about like running it. I'm interpreting the question to say it's running it in CI. And how do you make sure that only certain users can make, you know, changes in certain spots? And there's lots of things you can do if you're using GitHub, like around code owners and breaking things out, and using policy and all of those things to enforce that. But without further clarification, I don't know how to better answer the question.
Cool.
Well, and it looks like clicklick.com is only 100,000 to purchase. Thanks for the update there.
Oh. Nice. Got to put in some overtime this weekend, Eric, so I can afford clicklick.com.
All right. Next topic was, Minkata, have you been going through the GitHub Galaxy? Oops. The GitHub Galaxy keynote? Are you on the call today? Maybe not. Anyways, he brought up one of the announcements there, which we were also very excited about, but kind of dead on arrival for us. Required workflows is this idea where you can control what workflows have to run centrally in your organization. I believe that would be using like the .github repository. And workflows in here. So you can make some of these required workflows for like every single repository in your organization. That's awesome. Would have been absolutely perfect for us with 500 plus repositories, except for it doesn't work on pull requests from forks, which is like how open source works. So this is really just like a cool feature for your organization, not a cool feature for open source, like project, large open source projects. That said, we are working. What were you saying, Matt?
Oh, no, I had a different talk. Finish what you were going to say. I had a different thing from the GitHub keynote. Yeah.
No, so that said, since we can't use that, we're embarking on a different strategy. It's been available on GitHub for some time, but when you have a lot of repositories, it's a lot of work. So what we're doing is rolling out lots of shared workflows. So here we have this stub GitHub action here that calls a centralized workflow that accepts parameters. And that's the next best thing you can do. If you can't use the required workflows, you can start using shared workflows. So our workflows for testing of Terraform modules. Is here. So if you go to Cloud Posse, GitHub Action, Workflows, Terraform Modules, these shared workflows that we are in the process of rolling out for our modules are here. And it's really nice because shared workflows can call other shared workflows. So you can really dry up your workflows, centralize the management of those, and it works more effectively. All right, Matt, what was your observation?
Yeah, so I was just going to say they also released a new version of the of their VS Code plugin yesterday, which I thought was pretty cool. You can actually now see all of your GitHub action runs right in VS Code. And you can trigger them and get the logs and all of that kind of stuff right inside VS Code, which definitely speeds it up if you're developing on that. And now they have full support for the both IntelliSense and like syntax highlighting for GitHub Actions themselves, which is pretty cool. So if you're developing GitHub Actions, it will tell you, like, if you forgot to pass in a required a required variable to an action that you're calling, or if you're using a data type that isn't supported, or those kinds of things. The only thing that kind of bummed me out is it only works for the an action that's in a repository. It doesn't work like for reusable actions that you're developing. You can't actually like say this thing is an action. You know, it only looks for whatever's in the .github directory, which is kind of a disappointment. So if you have an action.yaml like out at the root, it doesn't run on that. So there's an open issue though. So go upvote that like I did yesterday if anyone else is interested.
That's cool.
I guess I've been using that for a while now, but I think it was only on the experimental version of that. So is now that all of it is considered stable?
Yeah, this is released, and it also the previous version didn't have this actually has like IntelliSense of like the GitHub context and everything, and it will validate that like the variables that you're trying to use, you know, deep within the context actually work. So if you have like on pull request as the trigger source, it knows that the event that you'll be using is a pull request. So if you try to use something that isn't on a pull request, it will like squiggly highlight that for you and tell you like you're using a variable that doesn't exist on pull requests kind of thing. It's pretty cool.
That's some good news.
Alex, you shared this link. This isn't new though, right? This has been around for a while, or is this different, Matt?
No, that's been around for a while.
Yeah, it's been around for a while, but I thought this might apply somehow to limiting GitHub Actions jobs that might have over-provision privilege.
I think this gives, by default, if you don't specify permissions, and your org setting is in like the default state, you'll basically get full write access to the repo that you're running in. You can change that by basically saying, by specifying any permission, which will do that. Or you can say by default, you basically just have read writes to your repo, which makes it, that's probably the most permissive or the most, logical org level setting you should set it to. And then if you need to escalate your permissions, you can then give it read, write, or none to any of these sub APIs that are, you know, for your particular repository. What I would really love to see them do in that workflow is somehow be able to grant yourself access to other repos, because that would be, you know, that would be awesome. But I understand why, like, having one repo say I'm allowed to have access to that repo doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense. But if they had some syntax where you could accept that or whitelist certain, you know, repos that are allowed to do that to your repo or something along those lines, that would be extremely helpful. Then we wouldn't have to have all these paths like sitting around to do things that we want to do.
Yeah. All right. Any other questions for today?
I got one.
Go for it.
Yeah. So I dropped it in Slack before, but basically my organization, we're looking to implement healthchecks.io. And so the first question was really, has anybody used healthchecks.io? Pause there. And then if you have, or if not, I just want to know if anybody had any feedback on it. But effectively, what we're trying to use it for is actually ECS scheduled tasks. And so we want a way. So right now, we create the scheduled tasks using Terraform. So my initial thinking is that, hey, at the time that we create the ECS scheduled, you know, the task definition and the scheduled task, why not just create a third resource, and that being kind of this healthchecks.io health check. And then and part of that question is, are there any alternatives to that? So, you know, I don't think EventBridge, or I don't think there are many events published to EventBridge, such as, you know, when a task definition is created, that's probably more of a CloudTrail thing. But I was looking to see if anybody had used healthchecks.io before, or, you know, do you have an alternative that, you know, you kind of monitor your health check, your scheduled jobs with? And for those not familiar, my understanding of healthchecks.io is you tell it a specific health check you want it to monitor, and you say, hey, it's supposed to start around this time, and it sends a heartbeat, and it's supposed to finish around this time, and it sends another heartbeat or a pulse. And if it does not hear back from that, you know, job, let's say after 6 hours, when you know it was supposed to finish in 5.5 or, you know, much smaller, it sends you an alert of sorts. Because there are some times where, like, you know, we don't look in ECS, and then next thing we know, we have a task that's been running for 8 days when it was supposed to only run for 30 minutes. You know, curious if anybody has any input or suggestions on how they handle long running jobs that might have just failed and nobody's paying attention to.
Vlad has posted some ideas, I think, in the chat here, a list of ECS events that are emitted to EventBridge. Also, you could probably do this with step functions. Now I'm hearing two different things. One is me reading into it. Two is what you're actually saying. I know of health checks originally because of this, you know, the cron job problem of being able to monitor that something's actually happening that is periodic. And for that, I've also used in the past OpsGenie. And I saw when I looked up DeadManSnitch, PagerDuty does it as well. Didn't see anything for Datadog. I bring that up because, like, if you're already using one of those two services, which is wouldn't be surprising since they cover incident management, maybe you don't need another tool for the same thing.
We do not. I get them. Like, yeah, we do not.
You do not use those tools?
Correct. Either. Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. I would bet if you thought, like, if you got creative enough, you could even use CloudWatch, because you definitely can get an alert when a task starts. So you could have an and when a task ends in CloudWatch. Mm-hmm. And they have the option for, what is it called? Treat missing data, I think, underneath there. So you can actually, like, in your CloudWatch alarms, you can actually say, I'm expecting this to happen, and if there's missing data, meaning like you never got the task finished alarm, you can, or the task finished event, you can actually like raise an alarm. And then obviously from there, you can do whatever you want with CloudWatch alarms. You can send them to email, you can send them to Slack, you can send them to pagers, like external services, you know, all sorts of things along those lines. So I think if you combine those two, you could definitely do that.
Good point. I think the thing that comes to mind though is I think the team that's implementing it was just kind of looking for point and click more so than,
an engineered solution.
Yeah, like off the shelf.
You're operating on AWS right now. Everything.
Yeah, right.
Hardcore engineering.
Yeah.
That's true. But off the shelf, someone still has to define, like,
right.
I expect this job to run at this time, and I expect it to end by this time. And if I don't, then that's an error condition or a warning condition or whatever. Like, unless we, like, AI has gotten much better than even all the hype about AI recently. Like, there's nothing that's just going to do that for you. You're going to have some sort of human intelligence around it to set up the alerting.
Yeah. No, I do like your solution though, Matt, of kind of tying it into cloud, the alarm system.
Cloud watch.
Yeah. Cloud watch, yeah. There's too many things prefixed with the word cloud, so it's hard to keep up.
And I think, isn't it Event Bridge as well? Is the other counterpart to that?
Yeah, Event Bridge are the actual events that you can read from, and you can actually send events to third party systems and all of that kind of stuff through Event Bridge. But I'm just saying, CloudWatch metrics and CloudWatch alarms, like the OG pieces of CloudWatch, could probably handle what you're looking for if you plan it out properly.
Yeah. Very interesting, because the alternative was, yeah, no, I like your solution, because we were going to have one, piece of it that actually creates the health check in, registers a health check for each job. And then another piece of it would be somehow, either a Lambda based on an event, like, hey, the task started and the task completed. And each time, it's firing a Lambda, which is making a curl or a post to this health checks endpoint. And so, why not just do it with the native tools in AWS? Definitely another solution.
All right.
Something to think about. Thank you.
Support this by default. I'm not sure about the curl thing, but step functions can run ECS tasks and it can orchestrate stuff around them and it can be triggered by Event Bridge. It's really worth looking into. I don't know why the documentation page is not loading right now.
Yeah, you got.
I think it's down or having a. Yeah, I was gonna try to give you some docs as well on just I guess there's container insights, and lifecycle events, but I can't quite get
those. Posted an example to a workflow that uses step functions to run glue crawlers, but you would be basically running your ECS job instead.
So I mean,
scroll a bit more, Eric. There's a nice definition. There's a nice image. Tiny bit lower. After tags or something, even lower. There it is. No, you went to a bit higher up. Yeah, this is the one with like get run. It caches. I'm pretty sure you can set timeout for how long an ECS task can run. And I don't know exactly about checking the status of the container.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could definitely do that, because you can call the API from a step function, essentially.
So basically, I think Mike's probably looking for a quick fix to what they have with their homegrown job system. But if you are entertaining like a longer term solution, Amazon has built it for you, and then you get all these other tangential benefits. So that's probably like where like the long term solution lies, and what Vlad's recommending maybe.
No, I've never really used step functions and never really had a use case for it, but this clearly is a use case for it.
Yeah, I mean, the native or the main use case for this is like step functions is basically a state machine. So if you have like sagas that you need to tie together that have multiple states and branching operations and all of those different things that can be long running over long periods of time, that's really what step functions was designed for. Mm-hmm. For that, for that use case. So yeah.
All right. Well, I think that brings us to the end of the hour. Thanks everyone for participating today. We're going to have another session next week, same time, same place. If you haven't yet subscribed to our YouTube channel, go to youtube.com/cloudposse to subscribe. We'll be posting this session there in a couple hours, so you can share it with your team. If you haven't yet connected with me, go to linkedin.com. LinkedIn.com/in/Osterman. Again, LinkedIn.com/in/Osterman to connect. And if you want to register for our weekly office hours, just go to cloudposse.com/office hours to get a invite link. All these links that we talk about every week on office hours, we syndicate some of those via our newsletter. Go to newsletter.cloudposse.com to sign up for that. Thanks, everyone. Have a great rest of your week. Talk to you then. Or talk to you next week.